It is my pleasure to welcome you for the first Gaudium et Spes lecture commemorating the 40th anniversary of the promulgation of the Pastoral Constitution on the modern church in the modern world. To be exact, it was promulgated on the 7th December 1965. In its introductory statement on the situation of man in the modern world, this document insists that the church has the duty of scrutinizing the signs of the times and of interpreting them in the light of the gospel. Gaudium et Spes insists that this should be done in a language intelligible to each generation, so that the church can respond to the perennial questions which men ask about this present life and the life to come, and about the relationship of the one to the other. Then it continues, and I quote, "We must therefore recognize and understand the world in which we live, its expectations, its longings, and its often dramatic characteristics. It is therefore befitting that the CERN, an institute for research on the signs of the times, should commemorate this great conciliar document with a lecture on the dramatic characteristics of the contemporary world." Vatican II never uses the term globalization in this document. However, in its teaching, it offers us enough food for thought to help us to scrutinize this veritable sign of the times and to interpret it in the light of the gospel. Globalization is a Janus-like phenomenon, a god with two faces looking in opposite directions. It is considered by some to be the panacea that will resolve all our economic, social, and cultural problems. By others, it is considered to be nothing less than a Russian roulette. Globalization is here, and it is important. However, it is not just a bundle of benefits. In simple terms, it indicates networks of interdependence which are creators, stronger threads of dependence. It is also essentially hegemonic, and perhaps this is the most dangerous aspect of it. In industry, we speak of McDonaldization. In communications, we speak of CNNization. In retail trade, we speak of Amazonization. And in the cyber world, we see of Bill Gatesism, come internet. It is true that as Christians, we should reflect with evangelical hope on both the benefits and ills of this phenomenon. But we should not be misled by political correctness. As the Nobel Prize laureate in economics, Joseph Stiglitz, wrote in his book, Globalization and Its Discontents, globalization today is not working. It is not working for the many of the world's poor. It is not working for much of the environment. It is not working for the stability of the global economy. To lecture to us on the challenges which this phenomenon poses to the church, we are proud to have with us Father Michael Campbell Johnston. Father Michael was born in London and joined the English province of the Society of Jesus 56 years ago. He started his studies at Manresa College, which is affiliated to the Institute of Education, University of London, and studied philosophy at the Jesuit Philosophy School in France. He also read for a diploma in education at the University of London and economics at the LSC of the same university, from where he graduated BSc Economics. He also studied theology at Heathrop near Oxford, and got the licentiate in theology in Mexico, where he was ordained priest in 1964. In 1967, he founded and directed in Georgetown, Guyana, the Guyana Institute for Social Research and Action. Later, he became a lecturer in economics at the University of Guyana and an advisor on social questions to the Episcopal Conference of the Antilles. For 9 years, Father Campbell Johnston was the director of the Social Secretariat of the Society of Jesus at the General Curia in Rome. He is also the founder and first director of the Jesuit Refugee Service. In 1983, he was elected delegate of the British Province to the 33rd Congregation. And during the years 1987-1993, he was Father Provincial of the Protective Province of the Jesuits, which comprises England, Scotland, Wales, Northern Ireland, Guyana, and South Africa. For several years now, Father Campbell Johnston has been involved in pastoral work at parish level in Central America. He was director of the Jesuit Development Service in El Salvador, parish priest in San Antonio Abad, and parochial vicar in Jardin de Colón. Since 2002, he has been parish priest of St. Francis of Assisi Parish and director of Bezan House in Barbados. In 1993, the University of Southampton awarded him an honorary doctorate in literature. It's a pleasure now to leave the word to Father Campbell Johnston. Thank you, Father.
Your Excellency, ladies and gentlemen, it's a very great privilege and a joy to be invited to give this talk and to come here to Malta this evening in order to give it. I say this not only because I too live on an island, Barbados, which is only slightly larger than Malta, but has less population, but shares, I think, many problems in common, but also because I first came to Malta 25 years ago, fell in love with the island, and have a number of good friends here whom I've been very happy to meet again, and some of them are sitting here with us this evening. However, I have to admit I was a little concerned about the initial applause, remembering what was once said by Monsignor Ronald Knox. He said, if I'm applauded at the beginning of a talk, that is faith. If I'm applauded halfway through, it's hope. And if I'm applauded at the end, it's charity. My second quotation from Monsignor Knox is slightly more risky, but I passed it, I think, with Father Joe, because he said, a good talk or a good sermon should be like a lady's skirt, short enough to hold interest, but long enough to cover the essentials. And I shall try to follow that prescription this evening. Though the topic is a huge one, and it's difficult to know where to start, I feel a bit like the proverbial mosquito in a nudist colony. It's all very nice, but where to begin? Well, I wish to begin with a brief look at the social teaching of the Church, because future historians may well look on the second half of the 20th century as a period when the social dimension of the Church's teaching and its apostolic work suddenly took on new life, reached a high point, and then, as the new millennium approached, started declining or being sidetracked. After 70 years dominated by only two social encyclicals, Rerum Novarum and Quadragesimo Anno, the early 60s saw a sudden outpouring of documents, notable not only for their number, but also their quality and a totally new approach and appeal. The two great encyclicals of Pope John XXIII, Mater et Magistra in 1961 and Pacem in Terris in 1963, opened Catholic social teaching to the world, the second being addressed, as you remember, to all people of goodwill. Their tone was optimistic and positive, claiming that the Church's social teaching was an essential part of her traditional teaching regarding human life, and could provide solutions to many of the world's most urgent problems. This process was further developed and completed in the great document whose 40th anniversary we celebrate this year, Gaudium et Spes, The Church in the Modern World, the longest and best known document of Vatican II. It provided a wide-ranging survey of Catholic social teaching and presents justice as central both to the issues of poverty and peace. And it calls for a change in international economic structures to permit the poor access to what they need in order to live. Gaudium et Spes was itself responsible for the veritable outpouring of social encyclicals and documents that took place in the 10 years after its publication. Just to remind you of the titles of some of them, Populorum Progressio, The Development of Peoples, for the first time brought the Third World fully into the picture and declared that development is the new name for peace. Then came Octogesima Adveniens of Pope Paul VI, which exhorted lay people to get involved in politics without waiting passively for orders and directives. And in the same year, the Synod of Bishops produced Justice in the World, with its insistence on justice within the Church itself, and its ringing declaration, action on behalf of justice and participation in a transformation of the world, fully appear to us as a constitutive dimension of the preaching of the gospel. And finally, in 1975, Pope Paul VI published Evangelii Nuntiandi, Evangelization in the Modern World, which adopts and baptizes the concept of liberation. In the first 11 years of his pontificate, Pope John Paul II published no less than 3 major encyclicals, all devoted to social issues. These were Laborum Exertiens on human work, with his profound and original analysis of the nature of human work. 6 years later came Sollicitudo Rei Socialis, on social concern, which develops the idea of solidarity, a key concept for the Pope. And finally, Centesimus Annus, to celebrate the centenary of Rerum Novarum. Written after the collapse of communism, it contains an important critique of capitalism as well. In the opinion of Clifford Longley, writing in a recently published book with the title Unfinished Journey, The Church 40 Years After Vatican II, these 3 encyclicals may yet prove to be John Paul II's most enduring contribution to the Church. And away from Rome, the Latin American bishops held their 2 momentous conferences in Medellin in 68 and in Puebla in 79. With their emphases on structural sin, institutionalized injustice, basic Christian communities, and a preferential option for the poor. Liberation theology was born and for a while flourished. The whole of this process had enormous influence on and was in turn influenced by many other sectors in the Church, especially the major religious orders. If I may be permitted to speak of the one I know best, namely the Jesuits, the promotion of justice was declared to be an indispensable condition for the service of faith. Our 32nd General Congregation in 1975 asked, "What is it to be a companion of Jesus today?" And it replied, "It is to engage under the standard of the cross in the crucial struggle of our time, the service of faith, of which the promotion of justice constitutes an absolute requirement." And it follows from this that the promotion of justice is not just one apostolic area among others. Rather, it should be the concern of our whole life and a dimension of all our apostolic endeavors. This outline will be very familiar to many of you, and I must apologize for repeating it in some detail. But I believe it's necessary in order to appreciate better what seems to be happening now at the present moment. It is now 14 years since the last social encyclical was published. though John Paul II did become involved in a number of social issues in his final years, such as a campaign to cancel the international debt owned by third world countries. But at many levels in the church, there seems to have been a general backing away from the positions adopted earlier, a sharp decline in concern for and commitment to social issues. A good example of this is contained in a recent biography of Father Bill Ryan, a Canadian Jesuit, ex-provincial, and director for many years of the Washington Center of Concern, as well as being General Secretary to the Canadian Conference of Catholic Bishops. The authors relate how in recent years many of the initiatives he took and works that he founded have been undermined or closed down. And they claim, and I quote, "The momentum that was generated by Vatican II, the moves to collegiality, ecumenism, religious liberty, and social justice, has not been reversed. It has simply stalled." And the already quoted Unfinished Journey, The Church 40 Years After Vatican II, which is a book of essays edited recently in honor of John Wilkins on his retirement as editor of the Tablet, makes a similar comment. "Today there is a sense of disappointment among many Catholics that the reforms of the Second Vatican Council have been truncated, ignored, or even undermined in the contemporary church, which continues to suffer from clericalism, centralism, male domination, and institutional defensiveness. There is a sense of an unfinished journey." Whether one agrees with these statements or not, there can be little doubt the commitment to more specifically social issues is on the decline. To return for a moment to the Jesuits, our Father General, Peter Hans Kolfenbach, declared to a recent meeting of social apostolate coordinators, "You are right when you say that the social apostolate has weakened, that in some places it is in danger, and that in some provinces it may have disappeared altogether." And a recent study of our social centers or institutes shows that many are facing an identity crisis, and some have folded up. The Jesuits, of course, are not alone in this. Other congregations are passing through a similar process. And in more general terms, the social teaching of the Church remains one of our best guarded secrets. It is rarely preached about, doesn't figure prominently in theological programs, and remains a closed book to most Christians. Some manifestations of it, such as liberation theology, seem to have disappeared altogether. It was partly in reaction to these trends, and with a desire to define more exactly what Christian social teaching has to offer to today's world, that the Father Bill Ryan I've just mentioned was largely responsible for organizing a seminar for social experts under the title Globalization and Catholic Social Teaching. It was attended by such luminaries as Brian Hehir, Gregory Baum, and some 25 others, and it took place outside Toronto in September 2003. We came to the firm conclusion that the Catholic Church has a lot to say that is not only highly relevant, but also urgent and needing to be said now. And this is the position I wish to defend in my talk this evening. I had hoped to bring with me some copies of the book that came out of that seminar, which has just been published, but I was only able to get the galley proofs. I wasn't able to get the fully published version. So I can only offer in their place a more modest pamphlet which deals with the same issues. It is called To Renew the Face of the Earth, Global Concerns. And Father Leo is selling it outside for 75 cents, I think. But before trying to outline what needs to be said, I would like to emphasize the tremendous advantage that we have. there is a rapidly growing interest in what we might say, with many people waiting to hear it impatiently. In January 2001, the World Social Forum was born in Porto Alegre in Brazil. It brought together a coalition of trade unionists, debt campaigners, peace activists, economists, and landless farmers, and was deliberately timed to coincide with the World Economic Forum meeting in Davos in Switzerland. This latter is a private corporation set up in 1971 to bring the world's power elites together. Funded and run by 1,000 of the world's biggest corporations, attendance is by exclusive invitation only. And the aim is to facilitate, I quote, unique working opportunities with other world leaders. The World Social Forum aims to be a reply to this, calling for a new world order and based on the ideal that another world is possible. The organizers expected 2,000 people at the first, but 12,000 came. At the second, there were 60,000, and it's continued to grow. The fourth World Social Forum, which was held in Mumbai, with more than 130,000 participating from all over the world. Chico Whitaker, one of the original founders, claims that the movement arose because traditional channels for political action have proved incapable of bringing about changes increasingly recognized as essential. And he emphasizes that those calling for them are neither revolutionaries, nor hippies, nor dropouts, but often well-informed and responsible members of society. The recent campaign to make poverty history is another example of massive public concern to redress the injustices and imbalances in our world. 250,000 people in the UK, together with the two British cardinals and numerous parish groups, joined hands at Gleneagles, where the G8 leaders were meeting, in an attempt to pressurize them to action. So it cannot be claimed that there's no interest. The interest is keen and seems to be growing all the time. Well, what is the main problem? I think if an alien from another planet came to visit us in this world, he or she would probably be struck most of all by the unbelievable inequalities that exist between human beings. Never has there been so much wealth in the world, and never has it been so unequally divided. According to the World Watch Institute, gross world product in 1960 was $10 trillion, while today it's $43 trillion, over four times higher. Some say it's six times higher. Yet one person in two lives off less than $2 a day. One in three has no access to electricity. One in five has no access to drinkable water. One in six is illiterate, and one in seven suffers from malnutrition. Though if only children are counted, this goes up to one in three. Our visitor would be astonished to learn that the amount of energy used by one American is equivalent to that used by six Mexicans, 38 Indians, and 531 Ethiopians. Year after year, the annual reports of the United Nations Development Programme underline this fact, with statistics that can only be described as shocking. I'm sure many of you will be familiar with them, but we tend to forget them or ignore them. So perhaps it's worth recalling briefly just a few. The 1998 Human Development Report claims that the 225 richest people in the world have a combined wealth of more than $1 trillion, equal to the annual income of the poorest 47% of the world's population. That is 2.5 billion people. It also states that the three richest people on the planet, Bill Gates, the Walton family, and Warren Buffett have assets that exceed the combined gross domestic product of the 48 least developed countries. As you probably remember, the experts distinguish between relative poverty, when a one-income family cannot cover basic needs in food, health, education, housing, or clothing, and absolute poverty, when it cannot cover basic needs in just food alone. There are 1.2 billion people in this latter category. And obviously, the inequality is not limited to income or money. Its effects spread across all the other dimensions of life in society. 325 million children in the world who have no access to any education at all. Of the 1,200 new medicines in the world market over the past 20 years, only 13 are for treating tropical diseases that kill millions of the poor, and so on and so on. One final statistic from the 1998 Human Development Report. People in Europe and North America now spend $37 billion a year on pet food, perfumes, and cosmetics. This figure will provide basic education, water and sanitation, basic health and nutrition for all those now deprived of it and still leave $9 billion over. This year's Human Development Report, which has just been published and which I haven't yet had the opportunity to study in any detail, carries a scathing attack on the impact of this inequality on human development across the globe. And it makes a point that it is growing, that the situation is progressively worse. And this is a point I want to emphasize now. The situation is described by some experts as unbalanced, by others as outrageous or grotesque. Clearly, some countries, such as China or India, have made some spectacular advances, and significantly, they've done so outside and independent of the Washington Consensus. But the overall picture is one of regression and growing poverty amid the ostentatious wealth of a few. And this is clearly stated in the 2003 UNDP report. For many countries, it says, the 1990s were a decade of despair. Some 54 countries are poorer now than in 1990. And in 21, a larger proportion of people is growing hungry. A further sign of a development crisis is the decline in 21 countries of the Human Development Index. This is something which measures not only gross domestic product per capita, but also life expectancy at birth, adult literacy rates, and an education enrollment ratio. And as I'm sure you remember, the UNDP divides 175 countries for which it gives measurements into three classes. Those who have high development, numbers 1 to 55, those who have medium development, numbers 56 to 141, and those who have low development, numbers 142 to 175. In the high development class, the first country is Norway. United States comes in place number 7, United Kingdom in number 13. The island where I live, Barbados, is number 27, and Malta is number 33, also in the highly developed countries. The medium developed countries, like Brazil, Jamaica, and India, and China, and then the low development countries, most of which are in sub-Saharan Africa, with Sierra Leone bringing up the table at number 175. But not only are these national levels falling in many parts of the world, the distribution of income within countries is also becoming increasingly imbalanced. In 1960, the income ratio of the poorest 20% of the world's population to the richest 20% was 1 to 30. Today it's 1 to 74. One could go on giving figures for the rest of the evening, but I'll leave them at that. There are many reasons why the overall world situation is getting progressively worse. The Make Poverty History campaign identified the three main ones as trade, debt, and aid. We'll return to these in a moment, but the important thing to notice here is that their combined effect means that the so-called aid of the wealthy countries to the poor is actually flowing in the opposite direction. Now, this is absolutely scandalous. The massive net transfer of wealth and resources from the poorer countries to the richer is intolerable and surely constitutes the single greatest scandal of our age. It is as though the wealthy nations are continuing, just as they did in the colonial times of the past, to live off the backs of the poor and exploit them with impunity. As George Monbiot has put it in his book, it is an obscenity which degrades all those of us who benefit from it. It is an obscenity perpetuated by the very system which was, or so we are told, designed to bring it to an end. I don't believe that any Christian or any person with human feelings can accept that such a situation is desirable or according to God's will. Every human being has a right to life and what is needed to make life livable. As the Roman Catholic bishops of the Antilles put it, any society in which a few control most of the wealth and the masses are left in want is a sinful society calling for change. A word now about globalization. We speak of many worlds. Most people are familiar with the first world and the third world. But we also used to speak of a second world, the communist countries, and sometimes of a fourth world, marginalized minorities in first world countries. Some even spoke of a fifth world, poor countries in an irreversible decline. But we really only live in one world, which is getting ever smaller due to the effects of what is generally called globalization. There's no one agreed definition of this complex phenomenon. I would like to adopt one contained in a recently published book by the Confederation of Bishops' Conferences of Latin America, CELAM, with the title Globalization and New Evangelization in Latin America, which brings together a four-year effort of in-depth reflection on these two key issues. The definition is as follows. By globalization, we understand a recent and accelerated phenomenon of rapid changes, mainly characterized by closer integration among countries and peoples of the world, which has upset the old systems of economics and labor, trade and international finance, communications and culture around the globe. This predominant model of globalization is based on and determined by what is known as the Washington Consensus. That is a concept of growth and development that dominates the U.S. Treasury Department and through it determines the policies and actions of the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund. It is a globalization that seeks economic efficiency and success at any cost and is based on free trade and liberalization. The Latin American bishops are not slow to point out that for some people globalization has meant life and creativity, progress and fulfillment, while for the great majority it signifies selfishness and frustration, exclusion and death. As Pope John Paul II put it, globalization is not a priori, either good or evil. It will be what people make of it. And so the task now is to humanize globalization and globalize solidarity. One of the saddest aspects of this situation, in which the rich are getting ever richer and the poor ever poorer, is that the experts know exactly what to do to put things right, but then nothing gets done. The lack is not in knowledge, technology, nor even finance, but in the political will of both leaders and the people who keep them in power. Where is the real terrorism today, one is tempted to ask? Surely it lies with those who refuse to change an unjust and inhuman status quo that is already spreading misery and death among millions. Cardinal Oscar Rodriguez, the Archbishop of Tegucigalpa in Honduras, recently said in an interview on the BBC World Service, "For me, the weapons of mass destruction are poverty, corruption, and social injustice." But unfortunately, these are not the weapons either President Bush or Prime Minister Blair seem to be looking for. As I'm sure you remember, in the year 2000, the largest gathering ever of heads of state signed the UN Millennium Declaration, which committed both rich and poor countries to achieving 8 specific goals, each with clear targets by the year 2015. The latest UNDP report shows that many of these goals already appear completely unattainable, since the world as a whole is moving away from them rather than towards them. According to his latest assessment, the world is more unequal today than it was 10 years ago. And it's estimated that sub-Saharan Africa, taken as a whole, will not be able to meet a single millennium target. The goal, for example, of free primary education for girls and boys, set for the year 2015, at the present rate of progress, will not be able to be achieved until the year 2130. And as I'm sure you remember very well, at the recent UN World Summit, which has just ended last Friday, John Bolton, the new American ambassador to the United Nations, who was imposed without the agreement of Congress or the House of Deputies, tried completely to rewrite the draft agreement just shortly before the meeting itself. And in his rewritten version, he cut out all reference to the Millennium Development Goals, all reference to the commitment of wealthy countries to give 0.7% of their gross national product to the developing world, and all references to Kyoto and climate change. Kofi Annan described this new US version of the draft as shameful. What needs to be done? Well, here it would be necessary to examine in detail the three areas already mentioned of trade, debt, and aid. And to them should be added the problems of the environment and the need for governance at a variety of levels. You'll be happy to hear there's no way we can do this now, otherwise we'd be here most of the night. The information is available in numerous publications, and even quite a lot of it in this little booklet I've already mentioned. But among the points, briefly, that need special emphasis are the following. First of all, with regard to overseas development aid, it's 30 years since the UN General Assembly approved the target of 0.7% of the donor country's GNP. Only 4 countries in the world have ever got anywhere near this target. They are Denmark, Sweden, Norway, and the Netherlands. For the majority of wealthy countries, the average is 0.2% and has been falling steadily over the past 10 years. of the 49 least developed countries, 31 receive less aid today than they did in 1990. It was therefore encouraging, I suppose, to hear that the Group of Eight at the Gleneagles meeting a couple of months ago agreed to increase aid up to the famous 0.7%. But, they added, we won't be able to do this till the year 2010 or even 2013. As far as the debt is concerned, numerous calls have been made, as you know, to abolish it completely. One of the best known is the appeal launched in 1994 by Pope John Paul II as part of a Jubilee celebration to welcome the new millennium. And development agencies around the world have long been pressing for alternative solutions to a problem that is such a clear impediment to economic and social growth. For in addition to the hardships imposed on poorer countries through structural adjustment programs of the IMF, the high interest rates maintained by the developed countries mean that in fact the debt has been repaid many times over. As George Monbiot pointed out in the book I've already mentioned, between 1980 and 1996, the nations of sub-Saharan Africa paid twice the sum of their total debt in the form of interest. But they still owed three times more in 1996 than they did in 1980. And even though the world's poorest countries have already paid far more than they borrowed, they still pay over £30 million every day to the rich world in debt repayment. As long ago as 1980, the Roman Catholic Bishops of Africa wrote a joint letter with the title, Forgive Us Our Debts, an open letter to our brother bishops in Europe and North America. And the bishops of North America replied with another letter, Relieving Third World Debt, a call for co-responsibility, justice, and solidarity. And the bishops' conferences of England, Wales, and Scotland published a similar statement, Life, Debt, and Jubilee, in which they speak strongly of unpayable debts. And I think it's worth listening just briefly to what they said. What are unpayable debts? They are debts that grow by way of the capitalization of interest faster than the debtor's country's capacity to serve them. Therefore, they are not steadily reduced as repayments are made, but grow and grow as unpaid interest mounts and is added to the original sums already owed. They are debts on which lifetimes of hard work and dutiful payments will make no impression. They are debts that erode a government's capacity to provide even the most basic health and education services. They are debts that see children turned away from school because their parents cannot scrape together the fees on which the teachers themselves depend. They are debts that see mothers turned away from dispensaries because they cannot afford the price of even the most basic medicine. Such debts impose the heaviest burden on those who are the least responsible for their creation. And so on. But easily the most important need, more important than aid and the debt, is the need for a radical revision of the conditions of trade that dominate the world and which are propagated by the World Trade Organization. Although this is hardly credible, the present world trade rules rob poor countries of £1.3 billion a day, 14 times more than all they receive in aid. And so what the developing countries want more than anything else is the ability to trade their goods and services at a fair price. Yet this is precisely what the wealthy countries seem unwilling to concede. The main bone of contention, as I'm sure you're well aware, is farming, which in the United States employs 2.4% of the working population, and in Europe, just over 4%. In the poorer countries, of course, farmers are the majority or near majority of the nation's workforce. In addition, they possess what economists call a comparative advantage in most kinds of crop production. Land and labor are cheaper, currencies are weaker, and sunlight in the tropics is stronger, which means that plants grow more quickly. And this is why the rich world protects its farmers against competition. It is estimated that the rich nations now give their farmers $352 billion a year, nearly $1 billion a day, which is 6.5 times what they give all the poor nations in the form of aid. In 2002, for example, the USA handed $3.9 billion, 3 times its entire aid budget for Africa, to just 25,000 cotton workers. And this reduced world prices by an estimated 26%, thus destroying the livelihoods of tens of millions of farmers in the poor world. Nor is the situation any different in Europe, with its notorious common agricultural policy. And I'm sure you remember and have seen this, that it's estimated that the average European cow receives $2.2 a day from the taxpayer in subsidies and other aid. Meanwhile, 2.8 billion people in developing countries live on less than $2 a day. The cows are more prosperous. And in addition to these subsidies, the wealthy nations impose high tariffs and import quotas on third world products, thus preventing many of them from entering the market. And there are many other advantages they enjoy. Among these are the TRIPS, trade-related intellectual property rights, which give patent holders a monopoly over their patented products for 20 years. It's estimated that some 97% of patents worldwide are owned by the wealthy countries. And considerations such as these are very relevant with regard to the patented drugs needed to treat HIV, AIDS, and its symptoms. It's not surprising, therefore, that developed nations are pushing free trade areas with all their might to open up new markets and consolidate the power of their multinational corporations. But these free trade areas, which are free for the wealthy countries, are by no means so free for the poorer countries. It's estimated that NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Area, has destroyed over 28,000 small businesses in Mexico and pushed 2 million small farmers off their lands through competition from the big agro-businesses. These and other facts explain why there's a growing awareness of and opposition to current trade practices. And it explains also the breakdown of various meetings of the World Trade Organization, especially the meeting at Cancun. But a recent Oxfam report claims that the United States and the USA are paying out billions of pounds in secret subsidies to their farmers. And they exploit every loophole in order to do this. And it's very unlikely, in spite of promises made by Tony Blair and by Gordon Brown just recently, that this will stop. A recent meeting of European finance ministers, Gordon Brown called clearly for an end to protectionism and warned that the West could not resist the challenge of China, India, and Asian competition by hiding behind protection. But as we've already seen, the recent UN World Summit in New York refused to discuss this problem. So I come to the final section of what I want to say. What can we do? What should we do? What should I be doing? I think it's obvious from what we've said that the church has a wonderful opportunity and could play a decisive role in promoting a new and better world. It's now 38 years since Pope Paul VI wrote in terms still very relevant today. When two parties are in very unequal positions, their mutual consent alone does not guarantee a fair contract. The rule of free consent remains subservient to the demands of the natural law. Trade relations can no longer be based solely on the principle of free, unchecked competition, for it very often creates an economic dictatorship. Free trade can only be called just when it conforms to the demand of justice. Obviously, globalization cannot be reversed. Globalization is here to stay and to grow. But it can be controlled, and it could be directed in the interests of the majority of humanity, rather than being dominated by a powerful few. The model that we currently have has to be changed. For as the Latin American bishops again put it, a model that explicitly or implicitly maintains the market as the single divisive force for development in a country or series of countries is A, unrealistic, because the market alone does not correct the great inequitable concentrations of wealth that it causes, is B, unstable, because it cultivates the volatility of capital and encourages financial speculation, making millions of people extremely vulnerable, and C, immoral, because it systematically creates exclusion and poverty, violating the rights of the person and jeopardizing the common good. And in very clear words, they state, a market economy that encourages indiscriminate consumption, lack of respect for the environment, inequitable distribution of wealth, and a superficial culture based on having and enjoying more than on being, destroys people and fosters lifestyles that are contrary to freedom, justice, and the welfare of those who are poorest. Those are strong and, I think, extremely important words. And they go on to explain how properly understood and directed, globalization could provide sufficient food and a dignified life for all the inhabitants of the planet. This may seem a very vast agenda and something that goes beyond the possibilities of many of us. And yet, we can become committed to change. And there are many degrees of commitment. None of them can be imposed on anyone. They must be the result, obviously, of a free choice, taken in full knowledge and under the guidance of the Spirit. Here I would just like to mention one or two of them. The first step is getting hold of correct information. And sometimes this is not at all easy, because the mainstream press or television, which are the most reliable sources, are controlled by groups with vested interest in maintaining the status quo. We've got to look for the true information. The second step is putting this information to use for the benefit of others. We can all be educators, even if we're teaching only the members of our own family, our friends, our colleagues at work. With well-digested knowledge, we can speak up when alternative views are voiced, and even contradict them verbally or in writing, and hear letters to the press and or parliamentary representatives can sometimes be very effective. The third step is to be more active to the solution through the type of work we do. Some of us are no longer free to change our type of work. Some of us have ceased working. But if we still have some choice in this matter, there are obviously some jobs which are far more directly connected with helping the poor and trying to work for greater justice in society. Also, we can become directly involved in the needs of the poor through a church or community group, a trade union, or local government. A fifth step calls into question our own lifestyles. Where and how do I spend my money is also a vote for the kind of world I want to create. And this applies not only to what I buy, but to where I buy it. As I'm sure you know, successful boycotts, for example, of Nestlé products did much to alert the world to the crisis of child deaths caused by the corporate promotion of infant formula in third world countries. And this consideration also applies to placing investments in companies that observe just practices without exploiting their workers or destroying the environment. The sixth step is to become an activist and join one of the many organizations struggling to create a better world. And there are a vast array of them, both international, regional, and local. And then finally, there's a step of total identification with the poor and oppressed by living with them and like them and seeking to work with them. This is a special vocation reserved perhaps for a few. But there have been some notable examples of it in recent years. For many, I believe one or other of these options could lead to a fuller and more satisfactory life, as well as giving a new meaning to our religious beliefs and practices. But I wish to end on a note of hope with one final quotation from Paul Kingsworth's book, One No, Many Yeses. He's a young author, and this is a book he wrote after spending some 9 months going around the world visiting these groups of people that were working for change and that believed that a better world is possible. And this is how he ends his book. I'm not old enough to remember when ascendant Marxists trumpeted the historical inevitability of global communism. But now I hear all over the world precisely the same argument being used for the opposite system. The claim is equally false. Nothing is inevitable in history. All this will change because it will have to. And when it does, the changes should be big, bold, and beautiful. Our job is to make it happen and to be radical and visionary as we do so. Why can't we abolish the WTO, the World Bank, and the IMF? Why can't we redistribute land, end debt, devolve power downwards? Why can't we feed the world? Why can't we abolish poverty? Why can't we redefine power, lock corporations and markets back where they belong, make democracy do what we were always promised it would, whether current elites like it or not? We can. The resources are there. So is the ability. What is missing is a willingness to use them. What is missing is vision, bravery, political will, a willingness to confront those who benefit from injustice. That is our job, to be bold. Not to tinker about at the margins, greening corporations, waffling about sustainability, proposing voluntary targets, issuing policy papers, gathering the crumbs from the table. Our job now is to call for everything we want as loudly as we can, and to keep calling until we get it. Who knows, we might even surprise ourselves. We will certainly surprise the world. And if not us, then who? And if not now, then when? Thank you for your attention.
Thank you, Father Michael, for your talk. Now, Father Michael will be taking a number of questions with another 10 minutes. Okay, so anyone who wants to put a question will please show up and send. Okay, so I'm sure that I will be expressing your thoughts if I thank Father Michael for his wide-ranging discussion of the real problems of our brothers and sisters who are faring much and much worse than we are doing. Father Michael told us that in the church there is a sense of an unfinished journey. Unfortunately, in some local churches, there's a sense that the journey has started very late and is moving very slowly. And it seems that, as one of Father Michael's confreres has entitled his book, the social doctrine of the church remains the church's best kept secret. It seems that documents of social doctrine are more commemorated than proclaimed from rooftops. I think all of us should be conscious as Christians that our small country has been a full member of the United Nations for more than a quarter of a century now, and now we are full members of the European Union. Consequently, let us all work so that the voice of the wounded Christ be heard in this forum. Our Christian being urges us to work to substitute the structures of the solidarity of sin by the structures of the solidarity of grace. Thank you very much.